primo cognome.
You can see it.
It's my brother.
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to get it. Yeah, I'm sorry, so it's our center. Jesus, show I.
So, Brian, you remember what's up?
If you can, you can.
All right, face that way.
The need to the target. So, then I can imagine what you're saying. But they have.
Good afternoon, please be seated. Pleased that you could all make it today. The first case for argument is 14-5134, Lucree v. United States. Mr. Lukasik, whenever you're ready. Did I get the pronunciation right?
The pronunciation. The courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature in order to keep the latter within the inside limits assigned to their authority. This appeal respectfully requests the assistance of the court to examine the constitutionality of the statutes involved in this case. Congress has changed our patent system from the Constitution to the Paris Convention to harmonize our system with the European system. Article 1, Section 8, Clause B of the United States Constitution grants Congress the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries.
Do you, sir?
The claims court dismissed this case on the basis that any condition Congress imposes on patents need only be rationally related to the promotion of progress in science and useful arts to survive judicial scrutiny.
Sir, I was just going to ask about that. We all agree, there's no dispute, is there, that that is the standard, that the requirement is that it's rationally related.
I'm sorry, I'm a new hearing agent. Everything's so loud, I can barely hear you.
Okay. Do we all agree that the standard is whether or not this is rationally related to the purposes of the constitutional provision?
I'm not sure. Let me go on. The first issue to be decided is the expiration of 1,532 patents every week times 52 weeks. 2013, the year, 79,689 patents expired. How does this expiration promote the useful arts as required by the Constitution? That's the issue, main issue. That promotes the progress of the science and the arts. The Patent Office on its website, policy matters contemplated for fostering innovation. The policy factors contemplated by the Patent Office, taken from its publication, fostering innovation, higher back-end fees, foster innovation and benefit the overall patent system. Expiration moves the subject matter of the patent to the public domain for subsequent commercialization. Right. Thus, the patent office supports expiration of the patent. The statement does not say that the invention cannot be made in China, Japan, and any other country and be exported to the United States before the 17 years, as early as 4 years. The Congress can solve the problem of expiration of a patent for non-payment of the maintenance fee by designing a more acceptable method of collecting the fee rather than expiring the patent. Placing a lien on a patent would be one possible solution. The most important part of the original claim is the decision to declare the European laws, maintenance fees, publication, and first to file as unconstitutional and thus repeal the act. Over the past 8 years, Google and others have spent millions of dollars to lobby Congress and produce an ingenious patent troll narrative which distorts the reality of invention in America. Most post-grant opposition also created the American Invents Act invalidate patents at about 75%. Article 3 courts invalidate patents at similar rates under the inflatable abstract idea category of subject matter ineligibility. Today, inventors are losing more cases than any time in the 224-year history of the U.S. patent system. The publication of a patent application before it issues gives potential competition advance notice of a product before it is fully developed, and it reveals a trade secret if a patent does not issue. The first-to-file system of the American Invents Act should be declared unconstitutional, since the constitutional provides exclusivity at conception for both copyrights and inventions. The inventor is then given time to reduce the invention to practice. On the European system, the race to file does not provide the required information to comply with the constitutional requirement.
Sir, right here. Didn't you concede, though, that first to file provision has nothing to do with her debate with the patent office regarding the maintenance fees and cancellation of her patent?
That's right. It's part of the court's responsibility to review the Congress for the public. She's a member of the public. That's why I've expanded this part of the case to give the court the responsibility to do their job in reviewing legislation.
So her.
But I can tell you why. I'll hit that in a second here.
Okay.
Recent research demonstrated that patentees in first-to-file countries lag far behind U.S. patentees in patent disclosure breadth. The study shows that U.S. patents have significantly higher page counts, indicating breadth of disclosure, and claim count, indicating breadth of protection, than patents originating from countries with a first-to-file regime. Claims court dismissed the challenge of the constitutionality of the patent office transition to the first-to-file system. The holding was based on cited case Medstat Engineering versus U.S. holding that a plaintiff did not have standing to challenge the first-to-file system where its alleged harms were speculative and not actual. Once again, the court said that, nonetheless, even if standing were found, these claims would fail on the merits, given the court's deference to congressional discretion over patent legislation. The court thus again failing to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature in order to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authorities. There's the effect on universities. Universities derive significant income from technology transfer and patent licensing. However, academic realities put different pressures on university professors and researchers. Operating under the mantra, publish or perish, scientists are more concerned with presenting their results at conferences and publishing them in peer-reviewed journals. After all, their careers depend upon it. Patenting the results is usually an afterthought. Under the former first-to-invent regime, there's no necessity for a researcher to rush a patent application to the patent office. The grace period afforded by the U.S. patent system allowed researchers to present their discoveries at scientific conferences and publish them in professional journals, and still have 12 months from the date earliest disclosure to file the patent application. A first-to-invent regime is then very important. First-to-invent to American universities, without a grace period, previously published results may no longer be patentable. A change from the first-to-invent, the first-to-file regime, may have the unintended consequence of a sharp decline in university patents, ultimately resulting in the decline of technology transfer revenues. Legislative history. Under the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton asserted in Federalist No. 78 that under the Constitution, the federal courts would have not just the power, but the duty to examine the constitutionality of statutes. The courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature in order to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority. The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar providence of the courts. In Marbury v. Madison, 1803, arguably the most important idea in Supreme Court history, was the first U.S. Supreme Court to apply the principle of judicial review, the power of federal courts to void acts of Congress in conflict with the Constitution. Executive branch carries out federal laws as well as vetoing laws and has a similar responsibility for interpretation and enforcement of the laws enacted by the legislative branch. The instant claim is not just a claim by the inventor, but it's a claim by a U.S. citizen asking the court to review the patent laws enacted by the legislature. The executive branch has a constitutional responsibility for reviewing the laws to protect the public. A police statement that to the extent that Congress deemed harmonizing the patent system with international standards to be necessary and proper to promote science and useful art, this was an entirely rational exercise of Congress' legislative authority. Appellee Oliver stated that Ms. Lucree's remaining arguments consist of a protracted exercise in speculation based largely on irrelevant reports about the supposed harms created by Congress. It should be noted, however, that many expert opinions have been included. Although not related to this claim, Congress is currently considering H.R. 9, which creates a patent system without inventors. Over the last 8 years, Google and others have spent millions of dollars to lobby Congress and produce an ingenious patent troll narrative which distorts the reality of invention to America. Post-grant opposition procedures created by the American Invents Act, that's what I'm claiming, invalidate patents at a rate above 75%. This is the same act that enacted the first to file challenge in the instant claim. The Patent Office has set up a fee schedule to foster innovation. The fee schedule is set up in three categories, micro entity, small entity, and large entity. With existing laws, interesting, increasing the number of patents issued to smaller entities only makes more patents available royalty-free after the patents expire. I have previously suggested a more appropriate classification of the Patent Office to bring the Patent Office back to the Constitution. During Mitt Romney's campaign, I suggested a way to solve both problems involved in the instant claim, that is, to set up two sections of the patent laws. First, micro-entity and small-entity inventors would be continue to be covered by the Constitution. Second, large-entity inventors would also be covered by the Constitution, maintenance fees, publication, and first to file. I recently sent the same suggestion to Jeb Bush to use in his campaign. Res ipsa loquitur.
Well, we are into your rebuttal time, so why don't we hear from the government? Thank you. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I think in answer to your question, based on the briefs that were submitted, the rational basis review standard isn't contested. It was assumed in Ms. Lepre's briefing, and the arguments were that...
Can you hear if you cannot hear? Is there a way you could try to speak as loud as you can?
Certainly, Your Honor.
That's what we can do.
In response to your question, I believe that Ms. Lepre's brief assumed that the rational basis review was the correct standard. There wasn't a direct challenge to that.
Even under rational basis, your friend suggested that, well, if you're going to do something, even if you can require the maintenance fees, you could put a lien on the property or whatever to try to seek the funds versus just not allowing the patent to continue. Why is that not an alternative means in which to pursue this if we assume this is a rational end?
Because that was a determination made by Congress, and under the rational basis standard, the court simply looks to whether there was a a result that was legitimate, that met a legitimate congressional objective. Here, the objective was to precisely to allow patent holders to allow their patents to lapse and to expire if the patents proved to be not successful, thereby having to avoid paying the continued maintenance fees for an unsuccessful patent, and that promoted the filing of patent applications. And that certainly, I think, meets the standard under the rational basis test. The second issue is whether this constituted a takings claim. As we explained in our briefs, the trial court correctly held that there's not a taking when a patent expires due to the failure to pay the statutorily required fee. And that's because the patent privilege doesn't exist independently of the conditions set out by Congress.
Let me just ask you, going back to the earlier point, is there a different analytical framework that applies to a situation where the patent office is using the fees to sustain the patent office? In other words, as opposed to when the fees are directed towards other purposes outside of the control of the patent office?
No, I believe the analytical framework still is the same. I think that question was addressed by this court in the Figueroa decision, and that specifically held that the patent office isn't that the fees that exceed the cost of operating the patent office can be directed towards other purposes. And one of the examples the court used was to help pay to fund the court's review of patent cases. And
I don't know that we get any of that money.
No, no. Maybe that was just a suggestion.
That, I believe, was framed as
the,
it could be.
But I mean, the argument that's made is that this whole maintenance fee process or procedure is more than necessary. And once you get the initial fee and there is then the disclosure, isn't that all that's necessary for purposes of promoting the use of arts, which is the only real congressional purpose we can have here?
Well, the court has held that Congress can impose under its authority under the Intellectual Property Clause a fee system. That was the specific holding in Figueroa, and that wasn't specific to just the initial fee or the reviewing fee. That the fee system includes all of them, the fees for both the application, the review, and the maintenance fees. And that was a determination that Congress made. And again, the purpose of it was to promote more patent applications so that unsuccessful patents can simply lapse at the option of the patent holder.
But is there any point at which the fee becomes so excessive that it doesn't serve any legitimate purpose?
Well, certainly the fees that will be set have to meet other tests under the Constitution, such as the Due Process Clause. However, Ms. Lucree, and I don't believe anyone has ever challenged the amount of the fees as being excessive. That wasn't part of the case that was brought below or the appeal. It was rather the authority of Congress to set the fees.
But do you think there'd be a viable argument to be made if the fees were set excessive? I mean, if Congress decided we'd like to get rid of our $18 trillion budget deficit by fees charged to patentees, do you think that would present a problem under the Constitution?
Anyone who made that argument would certainly have to show that the fee amount, say, was arbitrary. They would have that burden. And it's conceivable that you could have an excessively established fee. Currently under the eight.
Well, it's not arbitrary if you say we've got an $18 trillion deficit and we'd like to get rid of it. Again, I mean, that takes you back to the fact, does it not, that as long as there's some relationship between the payment of fees and the use of those fees towards improvement or efficient administration of the patent system, that's one thing, which takes you back to my question about why it wouldn't be a different situation if the fees are diverted.
I don't think, yes, it's conceivable that if Congress imposed excessive fee or very high fees in order to promote deficit reduction or fund the military or do something that has no conceivable, even tangential relationship to promoting science and the useful arts, that could be properly challenged or could be the basis of a challenge. However, that's not the case here. And last, as we argued in our brief, and as the trial court held, Ms. LaCree does not have standing to challenge the AIA. Her case, her patent expired well before the AIA was ever enacted.
Are there any challenges pending on the first to file system that you know of, that you're aware of? Any
constitutional
challenges?
I am not aware of any other challenges. However, I would note that the decision in Matstead that this court held recently was recently rejected. Certiorari was rejected by the Supreme Court. I'm not aware of any others.
In Matstead, the argument was not made that just because someone's a member of the public that they should be allowed to challenge it. I mean, under the AIA, anyone, for instance, can challenge the existence of a patent. So perhaps anyone should be allowed to challenge the provisions of the AIA.
Well, to have standing, you still have to show an injury, concrete and particularized, actual and imminent injury in fact. So anyone who was to bring that to have standing, they would have to show at a minimum that they're working on an invention or that there's a patent application that's pending, much less a patent application that's been denied for under the AIA, and that's simply not the case here. So if the court has no further questions, thank you.
Sir, you have a couple more minutes if you have something to add.
I've been a member of the bar for 51 years. This is the first action I have ever taken in the court system. I began my effort by writing letters to my congressman. In 1999, my local newspaper called me a crusader for inventors. In 2001, the Florida Lawyer magazine called me Edison's advocate. After a 30-year government career, I moved to the Punta Gorda, opened my practice. All of my clients were independent inventors, and one of them founded the Edison Inventors Association in Fort Myers. My motto, and the one that I kept repeating to members of the association, 10 two-letter words to live by. If it is to be, it is up to me. That's why I am here. I've paid all the costs of this action, and Ms. LaCree has authorized the court to award any damages received as a contribution to the USPTO. I started working my career for IBM, where I made two inventions, then went to work as a patent examiner. One invention was patented, the second was published. My most significant jobs were as assistant solicitor for patents, Department of Interior, Chief Patent Law Division, Headquarters Air Force Systems Command, and Director, U.S. Navy European Patent Program. After attending the first East-West Patent Symposium in Budapest in 1966, visiting Prague, Warsaw, and Moscow, 1967, I wrote the first paper on the Eastern patent system. I brought up my past experience because I know what the patent system means to inventors and corporations, and why Google and others have spent millions of dollars to lobby Congress to distort the reality of invention in America. There are two inventor groups currently working to stop H.R. 9, which will eliminate inventors. I just don't see why the Justice Department is supporting the work of Congress of reviewing the laws to protect the public. Inventors who are members of the public are Justice Department clients as required by the Constitution. I recently joined the Inventors Group with a design patent titled Stealth Origami. I love the few models I have here. Lucky I don't have any maintenance fees because it's a design patent. I also have two websites. I haven't sold anything on the website. My greatest satisfaction was riding in an antique convertible in a parade, flying one over to a boy watching the parade. I get my satisfaction from young boys. It's the court's responsibility. Oh, another one. One of the most interesting inventions I've patented is ergonomically engineered underwear invented by a woman. A friend of mine loaned her $50,000 to start the business, and said her invention was featured in Playboy magazine. It's a court's responsibility to give the patent system back to the entrepreneurs and the mompreneurs. A favorable decision is respectfully requested. It is also the responsibility of the Justice Department to protect the inventions and preserve the patent system. I have enclosures I'd like to give to the attorney for use in contacting the commissioner about this publication and two inventors, organizations, collectives for inventors. Inventors have nobody to protect their rights except the Justice Department. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We thank both counsel and the case is submitted. Thank you.
I'm going to leave those here.